Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really interesting topic, digging into some technical sources about, well, a quiet but massive revolution happening in construction. We're zeroing in on how things get joined together, specifically looking at the potential weak spots in these new, faster, automated methods.
Yeah, it's a big deal. The industry's under pressure, you know,
needs
to be more efficient, more automated, partly because finding enough skilled workers is frankly tough right now.
So the old ways, like bolting things together or welding, they're maybe a bit too slow for what's needed now?
Exactly. Especially with lightweight structures, like those using thin-walled, cold-formed steel, we're seeing a definite shift towards mechanical joining.
Cold-formed steel, you see that on things like prefabricated buildings, right? Or even internal structures and big warehouses.
Spot on. Prefab housing, secondary supports in industrial halls, loads of applications. And traditional welding is just, well, it's slow and energy hungry for that kind of volume.
Which brings us neatly to the tech at the center of these studies. Clinching. Sounds technical. Can you break that down for us? What exactly is clinching?
It's actually quite elegant, mechanically speaking. You're creating a connection just by pushing the metal together.
Yeah.
Extrusion. It forms an interlock.
Okay.
But the crucial bit is it only uses the material that's already there, the sheets being joined. No extra screws, no rivets, nothing like that. And absolutely no heat. No welding involved.
No heat. That sounds important. Less messing with the material properties and energy savings too, I bet.
Huge savings. And less potential for material degradation near the joint. That's why, you know, the car industry jumped on this years ago for making car bodies. Speed, efficiency.
Right. Automotive loves speed. So the potential for construction seems obvious then. Fast, cheap, good for lightweight stuff.
Theoretically, yes.
Yeah.
Perfect for standardized prefab construction.
Mm-hmm.
The big hurdle, though, is reliability. Or rather, proving it.
Proving it? How so?
Its use in major civil projects is really limited. Why? Because we don't have proper design standards. We don't fully understand how these joints hold up long term.
Right.
Especially how they fail.
Okay, so if you're building something that needs to last, say, 50 years, and it's going to face wind, vibrations, temperature swings, what engineers call cyclic stress.
Yes, cyclic loading.
You need to be absolutely sure about every single connection, right? Without standards, clinching feels like a gamble.
That's the core of it. We need to know the failure path. It's not like a weld where you have a heat-affected zone you understand pretty well. With clinching, failure is super localized because of how it's formed mechanically. We need to figure out how cracks start, how they grow, particularly at the weakest point.
Hmm.
And the research points very clearly to the joint's neck area. That seems to be the critical spot.
Gotcha. So the mission today, for us and for you listening, is to unpack how researchers are using some pretty advanced simulations to model exactly how these clinched joints might fail under that repetitive fatigue loading. This is the groundwork needed to eventually build those reliable design rules. All right, let's get into the model itself. You've got these thin steel sheets, a punch, a die, physical stuff. How do you turn that into, well, a digital simulation you can test over and over?
You rely on the workhorse of structural simulation, the finite element method.
FEM. FEM, right. Heard of it. Breaking it down into tiny pieces.
Essentially, yeah. You divide the whole joint into millions of small interconnected elements.
Yeah.
Then using software Ansys was used here, you can simulate the exact shape, the material's behavior, the forces, everything.
But standard FEM, that usually assumes things don't deform too much, doesn't it? Like things stay pretty linear. Clinching sounds like it's anything but linear. You're literally mashing metal.
Exactly right. That's a key point. Standard linear FEM wouldn't work here, which is why they use a specific, more advanced technique, geometric and material nonlinear analysis, AMNA.
GMNA, okay, why is that so crucial?
Because clinching involves massive changes. First, you get these really large nonlinear deformations just making the joint, the metal flows plastically. Second, and this is critical, GMNA captures the result of that process. It models the plastic strain that's occurred and, importantly, the residual stresses.
Residual stresses, like stresses locked into the metal after it's been formed.
Precisely. Internal stresses that are just sitting there because of the manufacturing process. Mm. If you don't model those nonlinear effects and the residual stress with GMNA, your simulation of how it behaves later under load will just be wrong, especially for fatigue.
So you're not just modeling the joint in use, you're actually modeling the making of the joint first to get the starting conditions right.
That's a great way to put it. You have to capture the as manufactured state accurately.
And the detail needed, I saw in the notes, this wasn't a trivial model, something like 378,000 elements and nearly 900,000 nodes for two thin sheets of steel.
Yeah, it's computationally intensive. That level of detail, using those specific solid 186 elements they mentioned, it's needed to accurately capture the stress gradients, especially in that tiny critical neck area. You can't skimp on the mesh there.
And they mentioned other methods exist, like XFEM, which is apparently good for watching cracks grow dynamically, but they stuck with the classical FEM for this part.
They did. XFEM is powerful for propagation, but for this initial work, just mapping the stress field before failure really kicks off, the classical nonlinear FEM was deemed sufficient.
Yeah.
More time-consuming, perhaps, but it gets the baseline stress state.
And getting the material right in the simulation was obviously key, too. They used a specific model for the S235 steel.
Yep. A multilinear material model with isotropic hardening. The important thing is they didn't just pull parameters from a textbook. They did physical tensile tests on the actual steel.
Right.
And then use inverse numerical analysis to fine-tune the simulation's material parameters until the digital steel behaved exactly like the real stuff. Calibration is crucial.
Okay, so we have this incredibly detailed nonlinear model capturing the geometry, the material, even the residual stresses from making the joint. Now, the big question, how long does it last?
Right. Phase two is the simplified fatigue analysis. Now, we take those stresses we calculated, especially the peak stresses, and see how they stack up against failure criteria.
How do they do that? Is there like a database for steel fatigue?
Kind of.
Yeah.
They compare the stresses from the model to the standardized SN curve for S235 steel. It's based on Eurocode standards, specifically EN1993-19.
An SN curve. That tells you how many cycles of a certain stress level the material can take before failing, doesn't it?
Exactly. S for stress, N for number of cycles. It's like the material's fatigue life chart. You look up the stress level from your simulation, and the SN curve tells you, roughly, how many cycles it should survive.
So they're basically asking the model, okay, show me the first place to break. Where does the stress get so high that the SN curve predicts failure almost immediately?
That's the goal. Find the weakest link under cyclic load. And the simulation gave a very clear and honestly quite startling answer. The absolute critical spot, the first place predicted to initiate damage,
right,
was in the neck area, specifically on the lower part of the clinch joint.
The neck again. Okay, here we go. This is where that specific number comes in that really caught my eye. What was the predicted cycle life at that absolute worst point?
Prepare yourself. The model predicted failure initiation at just 62 cycles.
62? Wow, that's incredibly low.
It is. 62 cycles. Think about what that means in the real world. A bridge joint, a building facade element. 62 load cycles could be, you know, a single windy day or just a few heavy vehicles passing nearby.
That's not fatigue life. That's almost instantaneous failure under any kind of variable load. It highlights a massive stress concentration, doesn't it?
A huge concentration. It suggests the current geometry, at least as modeled, is inherently vulnerable right there at the neck. It's a major red flag for design.
62 cycles makes designing for a, say, 50-year lifespan seem almost impossible with that specific geometry. Any vibration becomes a serious threat.
It puts enormous constraints on its use. And it wasn't just one tiny point either. The analysis showed that, quote, a relatively large portion of that inner neck area fell within the 500 cycle range.
Okay, so not just a single point, but a whole zone is highly stressed and prone to early failure.
Exactly. It confirms the neck region is systemically weak in this design. Meanwhile, other areas of the joint showed predicted cycle lives in the thousands or tens of thousands. So the problem is very localized to that neck geometry.
Knowing where it starts is step one. But then you need to know how it fails, right? Once that crack starts at 62 cycles, how does it grow?
Precisely. Now we move into fracture mechanics, predicting crack propagation. The researchers looked at the stress intensity factor, known as K, and particularly its range during a load cycle, K, delta K.
K, that measures how intense the stress field is right at the tip of a crack.
You got it. And KKIT tells you how much that intensity changes as the load goes up and down in a cycle. It's the primary driver for fatigue crack growth rate. So they introduced a hypothetical small crack, numerically, right there in that critical neck area identified by the fatigue analysis.
And cracks tend to grow in specific ways depending on how the load is applied, right? I think there are three main modes.
That's right. Three fundamental modes of crack propagation. It helps to visualize them.
Okay, walk us through them.
Mode I is the opening mode. Imagine pulling something apart perpendicular to the crack. The crack faces open straight up. This is usually the most damaging for materials under tension.
Like pulling a zipper apart directly.
Good analogy. Then mode two is in plane shear. Imagine sliding one side of the cracked material past the other, along the line of the crack, keeping it in the same plane, like sliding scissors blades.
Okay, shearing.
And mode 3 is out-of-plane shear, or tearing. Imagine trying to tear the material by moving one crack face up and the other down, perpendicular to the crack plane, like tearing paper by twisting.
Got it. Opening, sliding, tearing. So for this specific clinch joint, under the kind of simple back-and-forth tensile load they simulated, which mode was the winner or loser, depending on your perspective?
The results were unambiguous. The analysis confirmed that mode 1, the opening mode, is overwhelmingly the dominant mode of failure.
So it fails primarily by being pulled apart at that neck?
Under these specific loading conditions, yes. The mechanism is tensile separation at the crack tip.
And did the numbers back that up clearly? How much stronger was mode 1?
Oh, yeah. Significantly. The calculated aim for mode I was 1,234.4 imbipager. That was about 30% higher than the value for mode 2 shearing, which was 875.9. And it was a whopping 75% higher than mode 3 tearing at just 328.0. The message is clear. If you want to improve the fatigue life, you absolutely have to tackle that mode I opening stress at the neck.
That's a crucial piece of information for anyone trying to redesign this joint. But then there is this other finding that seemed odd. The sources mention negative K values. For all three modes, how can you have negative stress intensity? Doesn't K measure the drive to open the crack?
Yeah, that sounds counterintuitive at first, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But this is where the power of that earlier GM&A modeling, capturing the residual stresses, really shines. Those negative K values are expected here. They're a direct result of local compressive stress fields right around the neck of the joint.
Compressive. But the overall load is tensile, pulling it apart.
The external load might be tensile. But remember those residual stresses locked in from the clinching process itself. The very act of forming the joint creates localized zones where the material is squeezing itself together.
So the manufacturing process leaves behind internal compression right where the crack wants to open.
Exactly. That localized compression fights against the external tensile load trying to open the crack tip. It suggests that crack closure is likely happening, especially in the early stages of loading. Even though the stress is high, this internal compression acts like a clamp, potentially delaying the actual start of crack growth, even in that scary 62 cycle zone.
Wow. Okay, that adds a whole layer of complexity. The process that creates the witness also builds in a tiny bit of resistance. That's fascinating. All right, let's try to summarize. What are the key takeaways for engineers, designers, anyone listening who deals with structures? We've seen clinching is promising, driven by automation needs, big potential. But these simulations show a serious vulnerability, that neck area. Failure predicted potentially as low as 62 cycles. And the way it fails is mostly mode-ite tensile opening.
That's the core message. And the immediate next step, it has to be experimental validation. Rigorous physical testing. We need static tests, fatigue tests on real joints to see if they actually fail at 62 cycles,
right,
or if that negative K value, the crack closure, helps more than the model predicts. The simulation needs grounding in reality before you build bridges with it.
Can't argue with testing. And the simulations themselves need more work too, right? This was just simple tension.
Absolutely. The models need to evolve. Look at combined loads, shear plus bending, which is common. Look at temperature effects. Real world conditions are messier. And crucially, the research points towards parametric studies. We need to start tweaking the design in the simulation. What happens if you change the punch shape or the die geometry? Can you alter the stress field enough to reduce that mode I dominance and push the fatigue life up significantly?
Which leads us perfectly into our final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. We heard that the clinching process itself creates residual compressive stresses, leading to those negative K values that actually fight crack opening. So the provocative question is, could engineers deliberately design the joint geometry, the punch, the die, the whole process, not just to make the connection, but to maximize this beneficial residual compression? Could you turn what seems like a side effect of manufacturing into a deliberate engineered defense against fatigue failure?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? How to harness the process itself for better performance. That's the kind of thinking needed for the next generation of automated construction.
A fascinating challenge indeed. That's all we have time for on this deep dive into the nuts and bolts, or rather, the clinches of structural integrity. Thanks for joining us.